Let's get silly.
Hey, everyone. It's this week's episode of Taking It Down. We are the Alabama Takes version of a general pop culture discussion, and there's plenty more housed at that website. But, you know, you're with us. We're taking it down. We talk a lot of TV, quite a bit of movies, some music, and an occasional book. I'm Blaine Duncan, and in one second, I'm going to be talking to my friends and co-host Adam Morrow and Donovan Reinwald. Today we're going to be talking about a few things. The Netflix series I Think You Should Leave, the HBO Max film No Sudden Move, and it's kind of hard for us to pass up a week without at least giving a few thoughts and speculations on the Disney Plus series Loki. Let's let the music die down. Here we are. Hey guys, Donovan, how was Cape Cod?
Cape Cod was great. The part of Cape Cod located in Vermont was excellent.
Wait a minute. Cape Cod's in Vermont?
Some parts of it are. The parts I go to.
You're thinking of Nantucket. He was on Nantucket.
No, that's Martha's Vineyard.
No. Have you been adopted by the Kennedys by chance?
They're not so around anymore because they got this curse.
Good thing you're not adopted by them. Hey, Adam, serve me up your analysis of Wimbledon. How many hours have you watched a tennis this week?
I loved how you put that. Well, this is the end of the fortnight, the 2 week period where they hold Wimbledon, and I think all of us are sports fans here, all three of us. Donovan, highly into college football now. I don't know what other gambling problems he's developed in the last few years, but.
I watched a Pittsburgh Pirates game yesterday, and I don't know entirely why I did it.
Oh, the Pirates, man. They have one of the best stadium ballparks in baseball, anyway.
Yeah, they were playing at Citi Field in New York. It sucked.
Oh, well, never mind. So that's a good segue. You know, the summer months for a sports fan who just enjoys baseball, doesn't love baseball, there's some real doldrums that happen, except when Wimbledon's on, for me. I know tennis isn't for everybody, so the last 2 weeks have been, you know, they start play, those first rounds, there's so many matches to be held. They start at 5 a.m. Alabama time, so when you wake up and you got your coffee, you can really watch tennis until well into the afternoon, especially, you know, I'm basically working from home or working on music or whatever, and it can be in the background. I love it. So, unfortunately, they wrapped up today, and the bad guy won in my book, Djokovic.
Who won?
Not a Djokovic fan. So, he won. He looked very good, though, so kudos to him on the victory. But it will be rough once we're recording. We'll pull the curtain back here. We're recording in between the Wimbledon final and the Euro final. Italy and England will be playing here in about an hour.
We've got like 45 minutes.
I won't try to guess who's going to win there, but this has been a great sports few weeks of just constant action. So basically, tomorrow is going to be just the biggest fall to earth for me as a sports fan. There's going to be nothing to look forward to. It's going to be terrible. Just counting down the days until the Premier League starts back up.
My question is, do you watch tennis because you play a lot of tennis, or do you play a lot of tennis because you watch tennis?
I played a bit growing up and then played in high school, and I feel like telling people that I played implies like some sort of country club version of that. I've never like very good in that way, but I definitely enjoy, you know, David Foster Wallace has some great tennis essays. Have you ever read those?
No, I didn't know that.
There's a whole... like book-length collection of him writing about tennis.
This is also new to me.
He has an amazing essay on Federer, Roger Federer, when he was at his peak.
I like Federer.
And like kind of the art in what he does. It's really good. And I think tennis and soccer seem to inspire a lot of thinking. And tennis being such an individual's sport and so exacting in its... Everybody has to win. Somebody has to win every point, you know, and... just the spatial awareness and the actual space of the court is very pleasing to the mind and trying to like problem solve. I don't know. It's people, you can think pretty deeply about it. And it's great. So, but I think I have appreciated tennis both as a viewer and as a player. Like I am good enough to go play a competitive game with a friend, and it'd be a lot of fun. But not to say that I'm that good, but you know, keep the ball and play, that kind of thing.
Right.
And,
yes.
No, do you think you're going to do the new Wimbledon rules and douse your personal court with water? See who survives?
What are you referring to?
What was it? It was Venus or Serena had to leave, right? And then...
Well,
two people got disqualified, right? For not disqualified, they had to leave because they slipped a little.
Yeah, Federer's first round guy. He may have lost.
That's what it
lost
was.
Very early. You know, I think part of that is this is the beautiful thing about Wimbledon to me. You know, they grow that grass all year.
The injuries.
Well, it's people. You don't ever play on a grass court, even if you're a professional, because it's only in season, especially in Europe, for a few months a year. It's an insane expense to maintain, and so nobody ever really gets that good at it. Like, you can play on a hard court or a clay court year-round if there's no snow and ice, and people can manage to do that indoors. Obviously, you can't do that with grass, and grass is slick, and the ball doesn't bounce very high, so it's a totally different style of play. And I think, you know, part of what people were talking about with Wimbledon was they let the grass grow for 2 years instead of... Usually it's an annual thing, but since there was no tournament last year, so they're trying to, like, think, did that affect it? But I would also say these are professional tennis players, but they only play on this. You know, the French ends, and they usually play one tune-up tournament, the French Open, and then one tune-up tournament, and then Wimbledon. I think a year off not playing on the grass, even though they are pros, I think that they can get bad at playing on that surface. You know, the little micro steps that you have to take, it's pretty wild.
I'm so impressed that you had an actual, real, considered answer for my absolute bullshit question.
Well, it was, because the other thing that I think about, since I, you know, once you have gotten north of 30 and own a home, you listen to a lot of Bruce Springsteen and care deeply about your lawn. So,
yeah. And if you don't have any Springsteen albums, there's a guy that'll knock on your door and just hand you the whole collection.
I haven't hit, I think the next cutoff is like maybe 35 or procreating. Somebody shows up with gray New Balances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm waiting. Still waiting on the shoe transition. But I'm thinking about the grounds guy, you know, who your whole job is to have pristine courts for 2 weeks in the middle of the English summer. So, like, that guy's got to be just clenched the entire time. It's like, is it this guy's fault or is something else? So I think he navigated his way, whoever that is, whatever that team is, navigated his way out of that. I think there was a lot going on. It wasn't Wimbledon's fault.
No, certainly.
Adam, do you remember early 90s, mid-90s, Jimmy Connors sort of second wave?
No, I am too young to remember that. I did.
I got really into tennis right then.
Well, there was a lot of great American players.
Yes.
There was a great...
Yeah, he was fantastic.
There was a great ESPN, I think ESPN did it, doc that talked about, I think it was his final run at the U.S. Open, where he went deeper than he should have into the tournament.
Yes.
And it was a lot of night matches, and the U.S. Open is kind of famous for being the rowdiest of the tournaments because, well, for one, they let them play because they play
drunk
under the lights. Yeah, and they're like, I mean, this is at a time when, like, Wimbledon didn't have lights until, or they just got a roof, all these things, like, until in the last decade.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I watched that Connors run, and I was pulling so heavily for it. My brother and I watched that together.
It was a prime time event. It's a great documentary. So,
that was probably the last time I really got into tennis.
You said that's
I can watch
ESPN,
it.
Doc? I got to look it up.
Yeah, I was trying to remember the name. I also, this is an aside, but I wanted to bring this up anyway, but I'll use the opportunity. I got totally sucked into a new streaming service called Metrograph. This is named after, what are you laughing at?
No,
Donovan?
I'm laughing because you recommended this to me, and I'd totally forgotten about it until right now.
Well, yeah,
I'm laughing at myself.
I'm on Instagram, and there's a, you know, when you're going through the stories, one pops up, and it's for a documentary shot in 1981 called The French, as in the French Open. So the whole thing is about...
what
oui. So the whole doc is they... gave this camera crew, and this guy was a, I'm going to blank on his name, the guy who made it, a very well-respected photographer who also did a doc in the 40s that was something about the lights on Broadway, where it was just an exploration basically of neon lights, kind of the height of that, and shot it beautifully. And so anyway, this guy goes to the French Open, and him and his crew film from a few days before the tournament all the way through the tournament. They show like what the organizers do when there's a rain out. They show the total chaos of people trying to get in the gates, you know, and of course this is 1981 Paris, so people are like very stylish, you know. Even just your average person walking through the gates to see the French at that point is, you know, puts us all to shame. And the player, you know, you had Jimmy Connors is there, Bjorn Borg is there, McEnroe of course is pitching a fit. That's the year that he would a few weeks later he goes on to beat Borg in the Wimbledon final. So it's kind of the heyday of all of those guys. Chris Everett, who a lot of talking heads on ESPN now, but like just a different era where it, you know, shows them doing their own laundry at the tournament and that kind of thing, where it's just kind of chaos and puts a lot of art into what's happening on the court. Very good. No narration, just. But this service is very interesting to me because it's tied to a theater in Manhattan, 7 Ludlow Street. It's located right in the heart of things, and they, I guess, had to close for COVID, obviously, and started digitizing. So they had directors either appear with their films on this service and do like a Q&A. Like you can, it'll tell you like 7:30 on Thursday night, watch this film, and there's going to be a Q&A afterwards that you can interact with. And they're also curating collect, like Wes Anderson chose The French. And it's, you can see the total through line to the Royal Tenenbaums. But they have a lot of really interesting stuff. So if you're looking for a highly curated, sometimes we've talked about this before on here. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the world of streaming can just be overwhelming. And I found over the last week that just clicking on a service that if I click on a movie, it's probably going to be good. You know, like if I'm marginally interested, it's going to be good. It has kind of been good for me. I don't know. I don't know that I'm going to keep the service much longer. I watched the film that I wanted to see. They're doing some Herzog stuff. So Fitzcarraldo is on there right now.
Man.
And I need to watch that. So I may keep it. But so that's my half recommendation. Hearty recommendation on the film, The French.
What's the cost?
Like $5 a month. Not if you're thinking in terms of like movie tickets, you know, for the last year, had I known about this, this is not bad.
I like that TCM does similar things where like a director will suggest, but whenever you have something that's like a director or whatever, like these are the films that inform, like these are the ones I want you to see. I always think that's really cool. You know,
yeah.
Criterion Channel will do that sometimes.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah, they're great about it.
Martin Scorsese is always recommending and curating stuff, and it just is almost always worth it.
I feel like this is dipping into the same water as Criterion. I had Filmstruck and have not transitioned to the Criterion digital stuff, which maybe I will eventually, but it's been fun so far.
Well, last week we talked about the Netflix show Somos. I just want to do a brief check-in. Adam, you have watched no more than last week, is that correct?
Well, I watched 50 hours of Wimbledon in the Euros, so I did not manage to watch more Somos, unfortunately.
I'm almost finished with the series. I can still recommend it. I only want to say two things. This show is going to get a knock from me on my year-end list. I don't know where it's going to land, but it's going to get a knock for me because those, I don't know where in the hell they got these American actors. The DEA agents get worse. They get worse.
Worse.
I can't believe the line readings they give. It's like, shit, if I'd known, I would have applied. Okay, and my second take is that the actors who play Nancy and Benjamin, I seriously think they've got enough skill to be on an American screen one day or just an American show. So anyway, don't you? Did you think that?
Yeah, I totally did.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that young lady who plays Nancy. She seems like she's got a good acting career ahead of her. She's young enough, too, to break through. So, anyway, speaking of Netflix, this week, what a joy. What a pure joy. They released the Tim Robinson and Zach Cannon helmed sketch show, I Think You Should Leave. Tim Robinson had a season on SNL, but that was it. I think he worked there as a writer. He went on to do the two-season Comedy Central show Detroiters before he got canceled. He did that with Sam Richardson, who appears in a lot of sketches on I Think You Should Leave. That was Detroiters was actually one of the shows I returned to during quarantine last year and played catch-up with. I don't do a lot of catch-up. If I miss a show, I miss a show. But I did watch all of Detroiters. Pretty good. It's pretty good stuff. I do recommend it. Anyway, the Netflix show I Think You Should Leave dropped this week, I think Tuesday. Gosh almighty, that is a Tim Robinson showcase, and I just want to talk about it as much as we want or time allows. I was a little bit of a latecomer to that first season. I think I watched it like 3 months after it had dropped. It was a random choice. I don't even think I'd heard anybody talk about it much. I'm eager for people to watch this show. I'm constantly texting. If you're listening and I've texted you, it makes sense, right? It is just my brand of humor. It scratches every one of my itches because I love absurdity if it's done with skill. And Tim Robinson does it. Per my Twitter timeline, it's actually a lot of others' brand of humor too, but it's a lot of people I don't talk to just on a day-to-day basis. Donovan, you've watched about as much as I have. I think you and I are about the same. And Adam, you've watched an episode recently, so we can all kind of comment on it. We obviously all found it funny, I think.
Yes.
Do we want to...
Let me elucidate on that. My wife really wants me to stop watching this show.
I think my wife does too.
Yeah, she's so sick of hearing me laugh.
But she did laugh at a few sketches that were on while she walked through the room.
I've noticed that, she's probably going to come down here and throttle me, but, Beth is pretty good at blocking it out, but occasionally something will make her like chuckle a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is a commentary on your whole marriage, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. For me, really dumb people who have no sense of social norms and just tend to cuss randomly may sound like some sort of disorder, but I think it works so well for a sketch.
And it's like you said, you have to do it right. And I will say, like, all you out there in listener land, I think the example I would choose of this is the Ghost Tour sketch.
Oh my God, that's my favorite sketch this season.
At first it seemed like maybe it's not going to, you know, what's the, and then it just keeps, it keeps going and going, and there's another left turn.
Yeah, that's my favorite sketch this season, which is, I was going to ask you guys, especially you, Donovan, if you had a favorite sketch this season or last season.
Last season, I mean, it's hard to beat, so from season one, it's hard to beat the hot dog guy, right?
Classic.
But it's also, I'm also a big fan of the one from season one where they're like in a 50s studio and the guy just keeps improvising. It's like,
I forgot
the bones are their money, the worms are their dollars.
There's so many. There's a classic bumper sticker, honk if you're horny.
That's another good one. Like, if you're so horny, your stomach hurts.
Oh my goodness. There's this unpredictability that keeps you watching too. So even if a sketch isn't clicking with you, Tim Robinson and his writers have set them up to where if you're in the first 3 minutes of an SNL sketch, you're usually done. But if you're in the first few minutes of one of these sketches, you really want to follow it to the end because it could go anywhere.
That's a really good point. And also, like, first 3 minutes of an SNL, like, if you've gone through 3 minutes of an SNL sketch and you hate it, it's not going anywhere from there. Mm-hmm. You're done. But with this one, you know, it's like there will be ones that, like, start strong and end weaker, start weaker, end strong, which I think is more of a compliment than it sounds like when I say out loud, just because it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I got to keep watching it.
Adam, you may have a feel for this, even just watching one episode, is Tim Robinson seems to have a disdain for the mundane or the jargon-filled world we live in. That's just lovely to me. It was the episode you watched, that included the guy whose lunch was interrupted, right?
Maybe. I think I watched season one, episode one.
Oh, did you really? I thought you watched season two, episode
one. Nah, season one, episode one. So I will agree across the board here about moments of like laughing very hard. And then a few, I'm going to be honest, that had me kind of looking at my phone. Like, this is not nearly as good. It started out very strong with the corncob TV bit.
No, that's season two.
Is that season two?
It is.
Yeah, you watched the first.
So that was the first episode of season two?
Yeah.
Well, I have...
Which brings me around to saying a point I was going to make, which is I think season two is not as strong as season one, in that it gets more out there, more absurd.
I think I'd agree with that.
So does this episode you're talking about that you think I've watched started with the guy eating the hot dog out of his sleeve?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. Okay. His lunch is interrupted.
Yeah.
Something
that you was, can't do that.
That was deeply
funny. Something
about
him being like, I'm just more tired than I've ever been in my life.
Yeah. Eating the hot dog out of his sleeve. And my wife hates it when she misses lunch, or if she won't miss lunch. I can kind of go without lunch. And then just eat when I get home. But if she misses lunch, so I showed her that skit and she really liked that. Vulture's Craig Jenkins argues that I Think You Should Leave is about desperate thoughts we have and odd behaviors we bottle in order to try to look cool or even normal. And he makes the point that attention is nice, scrutiny is not. And that's pretty...
That's
pretty
a good... I like that.
Kudos to Jenkins, too. Same article. And he makes the case that this is sort of the twilight zone of comedy. And that not that it has anything to do with science fiction or horror, but I like that, too.
I have to think about that one. I'm not saying it's wrong, because it is kind of like, you got to pay. But that's kind of... Is there anything else? So this is the twilight zone of comedy. Does it remind... Is there anything else that kind of fits in that category? Just because... That's an interesting statement, and I don't know. I'm stuck on it. Maybe I'm going to unpack that slowly.
I think he was talking
myself.
About it, or trying to fit it in how we're... what this show sometimes says, whether it means to or not, about social norms.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Twilight Zone was kind of doing that, too.
I gotcha. Yeah. That makes sense.
If anyone on the fence on the show, there are only six episodes, and none are longer than 17 minutes. And if nothing else, you get some Bob Odenkirk and Tim Heidecker in this season.
I was a pretty big fan of that Bob Odenkirk sketch.
Yeah, that was a good one, too.
That was very solid. They really let Odenkirk...
it is a very low commitment. Low commitment level. I need to keep watching.
Oh, it's, yeah. And if anyone out there is watching and you want to just text me random lines, please do. Please do. I'm a huge fan of doing that as well. Or just tweet at me. Let's move into our discussion of the HBO Max movie from filmmaker Steven Soderbergh. It's No Sudden Move. It's a crime thriller. A lot of outlets saying that it's Soderbergh's return to form, or at least returning to something he excels at doing. It stars Benicio del Toro, one of my favorite actors. Is he the most, you know, we could get stupid here, but is he one of the most underrated actors ever?
Probably. And I don't know if, and is that him just being a grade A weirdo, or is that just like he's done the work and no one cares?
So is he a weirdo? I've never read about his personal life.
I think he's kind of a weirdo.
Love it. Benicio del Toro and Don Cheadle. And it's also got David Harbour, John Hamm, Julia Fox, Ray Liotta makes an appearance. So also some of my favorite folks.
Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, thank you. In the year of our Lord 2021.
I got to say, Brendan Fraser appearing as a, you know, you think back to the Tarzan and the Mummy Man and all of these things, just like a young, shredded dude. And here, you know, there's been pictures of him floating around for years, kind of like, whoa, what's happened to him? It's like, well, he's a successful middle-aged man. Screw it. What's he got left?
Turns out Brendan Fraser can play a gangster.
Yeah, it was great. He was great.
I loved it.
Is it now that we point out that his gangster's name is Doug Jones?
Love that too. Yeah, I think we should.
All right. If you want to know more, as in, you know, as if that isn't enough to get you to watch it, it's set in 1950s Detroit, and a gangster is recruited to do some threatening, blackmailing, / weird babysitting kind of stuff. He's fresh out of prison. He wants to leave town, but he needs a little cash. So he agrees to do this. That's all you need to know right there.
This is the Don Cheadle character. Yeah.
That's the John Cheadle character. I like going in knowing as little as I can, so let's just draw a spoiler line right here, okay? And we're going to start talking about our thoughts on it. So, what did you guys think? Did you like it?
I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought the, you know, sometimes with these intricate crime dramas where you're discovering plot along with the characters, sometimes I can get a little lost or it feels a little overwrought. I didn't find that with this. You know, our kind of our classic test of, did I look at my phone? No, I didn't. It was a lot of fun. It was nuanced enough, and there were enough twists and turns, but they all felt earned. And that's to say nothing of the performances, which I thought were great across the board. And I'm sure we'll get into that.
I'd also give it a thumbs up. I'll second Adam there, saying, you know, that it passed the phone test. It kind of weirdly, because this movie, it didn't exactly work in like act one, two, or three, but it kind of had like distinct periods where distinct things are happening. And I don't think at any moment, just about every moment was mesmerizing. Like I could watch this scene go on and on and on. My other comment, which I'm not going to explain, justify, or defend in any way, is it felt like every Steven Soderbergh movie I've ever seen got put in a blender and spit out and became this movie. Which, if you like, you know, he does his own camera work. It's very, I can't explain or defend this, but I had a feeling that like this movie kind of come out and like, despite probably being shot digitally, like this could have come out in 1995, just with like sometimes the way it looks, sometimes the camera work. That's not necessarily a negative. That's my review.
Heavy use of the fish lens camera.
Lens. Almost the whole thing. I actually, when it started, and it was, the camera's kind of following Cheadle around, and Brendan Fraser's kind of recruiting, I thought, well, I should make a mental note of this choice of camera work here, you know, because this is interesting and it's kind of providing like a heightened reality sense for who's in focus and who is on the edge being distorted or just out of focus, or, you know, how is that reflecting mental states, blah, blah, blah. But it kind of just kept on with that for the entire thing.
It's almost like, I guess he wanted to unsettle or disorient the whole film. It does sometimes feel like you're watching the film have a migraine because there's so much fisheye in it. But I never got annoyed or distracted by it, really.
No. I thought it was beautiful. It also gave it a sense of place a little bit because it felt like you were watching on a 1958 television or whatever.
And the sets looked amazing. And I wonder if both the people and the any time leanness that was applied to it, anything that was supposed to be of an era, was very, it looked cool. You know, it looked like Detroit would have been at its peak, right? At this moment where there's a lot of auto money, but before the riots, that kind of, I don't know if that, my Detroit history is not great, but it seems like the economic sweet spot. And I don't know if maybe choosing that camera angle allowed them to make what was in focus that much better instead of worrying about like a sprawling set. You know, but it was very cool.
Car enthusiasts will definitely enjoy this movie a lot because they're going to bring some knowledge to the table about the catalytic converter. It turns out that was the MacGuffin kind of thing. Did you guys pick up on the first time it was mentioned that they're talking about a catalytic converter?
I think actually said it.
I think they mispronounced it maybe the first or second time, right?
So I had some kind of idea, but I didn't really connect the dots with like, wait a minute. This was something the car industry was really against at this time.
No, that part I didn't know, but I can remember as a kid mispronouncing it and calling it a Cadillac converter or whatever.
That's right. They do call it like a Cadillac.
They think it's a Cadillac thing. Yeah.
I think it's it's a piece.
I feel like they said catalytic early, but it doesn't really... That's what you're right. That's what they say. The dots don't always connect.
So there's a little bit of truth to this that they tried to push the information of a catalytic converter down for cost-saving measures, and they didn't want anyone to have their hands on it.
All four majors. Yeah. When that screen popped up at the end with the, you know, the this is what really happened, or this is the continue. I was surprised because the tone of the film was not that. At all. No. You know, it didn't feel like Don Cheadle's character went on to be very successful when one of those kind of things.
Right.
So that was a little surprising. It's not at all. But which that you know, I did wonder what points they were making there and how they were tying that to what we know of Detroit now with redlining and white flight and urban decay, all those kind of things. I thought, like, the point that was made when Don Cheadle goes to visit and picks up the suitcase, that was, like, a human moment of, like, yeah, they're going to bulldoze our neighborhood. I didn't totally understand how... It seemed like they wanted to tie those two things. Mm-hmm. You know, the automobile is totally tied into that history, but, like, who the power brokers are in that situation, it felt like they were swinging for the fences on those points, and I didn't maybe follow the whole time what they were, the big points, you know, like the capitalized big idea.
Brian, I think it's Tyler Rico from RogerEbert.com. Yes. His kind of thesis for this movie, which I had read his review before watching it, and his thought is that Soderbergh is more, he's mostly intrigued in, like, looking at structures of power. But I'll say, having had that in my mind and then actually watching the movie, I'm not sure the dots always connected for me. Like, I see that, but also sometimes it was like, wow, what did we learn out of this situation?
Yeah, like,
yeah, that's one of my major complaints of the film.
To totally go spoiler here, when John Hamm walks in at the end and returns the cash, and you're like, well, of course. You know, and like, there's, yeah, that's supposed to be like the, kind of point, and...
Yeah.
I mean, it was fun, and I got it. I think maybe there were some points missed from, if he's trying to go from A to D, B and C might have been skipped or weak links. I don't know.
Yes. No, I agree. I think that's exactly the way it was. And it didn't have that kind of awe reaction that you're supposed to get. It didn't for me, and it didn't for you, it sounds like. The themes should have been better weaved from the start rather than dropping them in at certain points. Now, does that hurt the movie? Not a ton, not for me. I was very entertained, didn't find it boring at all. It's a good 2 hours. It clips along at a nice pace. All the characters are interesting. It's very well acted. There's this scene where Don Cheadle's character tells Benicio del Toro's character that, I know you're sleeping with this mobster's wife. And if you'll go and watch that Benicio del Toro reaction, it's just perfect. He gives the slightest, like, oh, okay. I didn't realize it was that obvious. And he says all that with just a one-second look.
He was great. He was great in it. And the tension around that plot point, like where he goes to the guy's house and is accused of that, and he refuses that knowledge, or refuses to acknowledge it. And then the guy accuses his wife of the same thing. He's fishing like that. There were moments of tension like that where it's all who knows what when and who's supposed to know what when. And they keep saying that Del Toro's character is not... You know, he thinks he's smarter than he actually is, which makes him dangerous. You know, that he can't... They're totally not threatened by him because they don't think that he could weave together a good enough plan. All that, all those plot points were a lot of fun. And it, yeah. I think, to your point, Blaine, kind of what you started with there, it was hyper-entertaining, very, very enjoyable, incredible acting performances. If they had really landed the plane on connecting those dots that we talked about, I think it goes from being like, this was a great way to spend a Friday night to like a really great film. And I they didn't hit that, I don't think.
You know, I find that like a lot of, the guy's made like 25 movies. So I say, I haven't seen most of his movies and I've probably seen, you know, I don't know, 8 or 9. But I often feel like a lot of his movies kind of leave me feeling a little cold at the end of it like that, where it's like, this was a really cool like genre or technical exercise, but at the end of it, it's kind of like, like I feel like it was a little less than the sum of its parts, if that makes sense. And I kind of was a little left with the feeling that this was a little less than the sum of its parts. I think if you want to do maybe a fairly generous reading, it's that the story is so much about, if we're thinking about it as in terms of power and power dynamics, it's a very cynical look at what happens when you try and get above your station, happens when you try and fight City Hall. But yeah, I think that's not unique to this film, at least with the stuff of Soderbergh's I've seen.
You're right, and Adam's right too, in that if he could have weaved that in throughout, it would have been a stellar movie.
You know, and it was still, like, I left watching this movie like, that was pretty good. Like, I liked it. Mm-hmm. They were, like, talk about great moments when the phone is ringing in the kitchen. That scene was absolutely incredible. It was fun. Great, great, great acting. So I'd still, this is still definitely a recommend, and I think folks will, you'll get out of it what you get out of it.
Yeah, I was about to wrap by saying, I think anyone who's looking for a movie to watch and is not going to talk about it on a podcast is going to find that it's a great movie. When you start dissecting it and really digging into it, and you see that those bigger ideas are blatantly stated a few lines into the back half of the film, then you say, "Oh, well, it could have been this and this." So those are our thoughts on that. You can find that movie on HBO Max if you haven't seen it. I'm assuming you did if you listened to us break it down a little bit. We're going to take a break, a very short break, and then what we'll do is we'll come back on the back half and talk a little Loki, the newest episode, the penultimate episode of Loki, actually. We'll get to that in a second. Hey, we thank you for listening. It's a much appreciated show. Your support any way you wish. You can share us online, tell a friend, rate and review the podcast on your app, visit thealabamatake.com for more, or even donate or buy something from the online store, all of which can be found by going to thealabamatake.com. As for shows, coming soon will be the last of the bonus episodes of This Song Sucks, and then in the fall will be the debut of the second season. We're looking forward to it. Short Takes, which is on our YouTube channel for The Alabama Take and also on the website, has new episodes every Friday morning. This week is going to be guest James McMurtry. It's an exciting episode. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and you won't miss that, hopefully. And like most folks, we're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, which are useful reminders of for you when we have new things for you to check out. Let's get into the second half of this week's Taking It Down, which has a Loki conversation already in process.
Wait, we've been talking about Loki.
Yeah. So who's the big bad?
Was it just me or was Richard E. Grant a tad underused as old Loki?
Until he started building Asgard and like...
I mean, that was cool.
Picture him in that costume in a giant green screen room just like doing all those facial things and all those like, motions.
I really like that both of the, what I'll term the fun Marvel shows... WandaVision in this one.
Yeah, so the good ones.
Have introduced the saggy classic costumes.
Yeah. Very good. There was a little too much, I don't know if form-fitting is the right word on his costume, but there was like...
I wasn't looking.
Could see a little outline. It was a little too much peen for me.
You know, I think I was sitting far enough back from the TV that...
Well, I only noticed on the second watch through, so...
Okay, that's when you're looking for Easter eggs, and yeah, that's looking the biggest one.
For those little details.
Hey, not so little from what I hear.
So do you think we'll get the, what is it, the pet Avengers, now that we've got Throg
God,
in the mix?
God, I hope so. No.
And then Alligator Loki can come back.
He's very barely in it, but I would love to see, like... Marvel, embrace the, like, stupid cosmic Jack Kirby nonsense that people love it.
It's what everybody is talking about. I mean, that's, like Kid Avengers, Pet Avengers. It's all over the internet because it's all people want. It's like, forget this, like, serious war shit. Give us the dumb stuff.
Or just, like, please stop, like you need to stay in your lane and know who you are. Please stop trying to solve racism.
Right.
Just give us the Kid Avengers.
Right.
Stop trying to explain America to itself.
Yeah. Like, we either get it or we don't, and we don't care to change our minds.
Absolutely. Oh, man.
Give him one final thought on this episode of Loki.
You know, I kind of miss the buddy comedy that we got in the beginning. I didn't know what we had till it was gone. It's getting a little bit more frantic, but is that as much fun as them solving crimes? Not at all.
I have two questions for you before you leave. One, okay. Is Owen Wilson, or sorry, Mobius, is Mobius a Loki? And two, is the man behind the curtain also a Loki?
I think that Mobius is not a Loki. Man, I hope it's not a Loki. Wouldn't that suck? Bring in someone cool.
I think it'd be pretty cool. I mean, I think it'd be great. And then that's when we can introduce like the multiverse of madness, because they're just like, okay, let's just roll with this, blow up the TVA, and here's how we introduce all these new movies coming up.
I would be, if they do it right, you know, I take that back, actually. If it's a Mobius, but it's a Tom Holland Loki, because he just seems like he was having so much fun being President Loki and being regular Loki and being some of the other Loki. He's just been having a good time. The Loki that won the Olympics.
The Tour de France Loki.
Is that what it is? I couldn't see well enough.
Yeah, those yellow jersey.
Yeah, it's great. Like, Lokis go on and do a lot of different things as long as they're played. I think I called him Tom Holland. As long as they're played by Tom Hiddleston.
You were close. Tom H.
Another TH character.
As long as it's Tom Hanks. I hope Tom Hanks is the next Loki.
Holy shit, I take it all back if they go and it's Tom Hanks is the man behind the curtain and he's a Loki.
Be great. That'd be amazing. And he does the... What if it's Tom Hanks and they pull back the curtain and he does the Owen Wilson wow and then that's the end.
Wow! But it's Tom Hanks doing it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'd watch that. I'd heck, would I watch it? No, I'd move into Disney World. That's it for this week. We'll return bright and early next Tuesday to opine on that last episode of Loki, as well as the long-awaited return from Marvel to the big screen with Black Widow. And who knows? Something else, I'm sure. Talk to you later. I'm Blaine Duncan.
And we've been great.
And we've been great.